during the troubles in Belfast, an American came over to visit the city. He was walking down the border area, and a man jumped out of the shadows, put his arm around his neck, put a knife to his throat, and said to him, "Declare yourself, what religion are you?" And the man thought fast, and he said, "Well, I'm a Jew." And the terrorist said, "Praise Allah," and he split his throat. The moral of that story is that before you talk, you better know your audience. I was thinking about that, being here with you, and it strikes me that God is doing things in this land that has been so troubled. And the great advantage that many of you have is that you know your audience. Intuitively, you know the people of the North, the South. It takes years for somebody from the outside to get that sensitivity. And I am convinced that hearing you, that God's at work. And one of the things you can expect is you're going to get opposition. Get it from the outside, even worse, you'll get it from the inside. But if it's true that there is a moving of God in this land, then Satan's not going to give it up without playing a hard game. And so I wanted to commit myself to praying for you. And grandson, Carrie, is here, and thought I'll be gone before the whole moving of God takes place, but he may look back in the years to come and say, I was there when it started. I saw the moving in the bramble bushes. I saw the little spots of light. And so I admire you as a soldiers of Jesus Christ in this land that for so long had a form of religion but no power. I'm grateful for the time we've spent together. Our scripture this morning comes from the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 13. Now, all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. I'd like to make a confession this morning, and that is that I am bringing you the message of another preacher. For that is, after all, the way that Solomon, the author of Ecclesiastes, introduces himself. In verse 1, he says, the preacher, son of David, king over Jerusalem. Word for preacher in the Hebrew is the word kohelek. It's the word for a man who addresses an assembly of people. Corresponding word in the Greek is the word ecclesiastic, and that's where the book of Ecclesiastes gets its name. Only problem with this ancient preacher is that many people feel he was backslidden. They think of him as a wolf in sheep's clothing, and not a particularly convincing sheep at that. Ancient rabbis had all kinds of difficulty with this preacher, and many of them felt he ought not be allowed into the library of inspiration. They were not the only ones. Martin Luther was so bewildered by this book that he decided it could not have been written by Solomon at all. Instead, he suggested that it was written by a scribe in the second century before Christ. He imagined that that scribe had gone down to Egypt and visited the library of Ptolemy Ergetes and then took the wisdom of Egypt, brought it back to Israel, and somehow got it included in the Bible. And once Luther took that path, a great many folks felt free to follow in his tracks. Most liberal scholars do not believe that the book was written by Solomon at all. In fact, they don't believe that the book is a unity. They see the book as more like a scissors and paste job. In the book, there are several different voices. There's Kohelet, the preacher, who's something of a cynic and a skeptic. And then there's a pious man who tries to set him straight. And then, for reasons not quite clear, there's a wise man who keeps dropping in witticisms and wise sayings. And even those who believe that the book is a unity aren't quite agreed as to what the book is all about. Now, Cornhill and Delitzsch, two of the commentators on this book of Ecclesiastes, say that the book of Ecclesiastes is a triumph of faith over reason. Here's a man who looked life square in the face and was puzzled by what he saw. And yet at the end of the book, even though his reason said one thing, is a great affirmation of faith. W.G. Hendry in the New Bible Commentary takes a completely different tack. He says the audience for this preacher is not the people of God, but the people outside the community. People who have all kinds of different ways of coming at life. And so the purpose of the preacher is to show those people that their philosophy will not work. He exposes what they believe to the rough, crude winds of life to show that their thinking will not stand. Even the editors of the Scofield Bible had difficulty ordaining this preacher. If I understand their comment in chapter 2, chapter 11, they say that the book of Ecclesiastes is the musings of a man living under the sun. Somebody tied to time, to space. The book, they say, is inspired in that it's an accurate revelation of what a man like that would think, but there is no real revelation here. Nothing in this book that can move us on to God. I have difficulty accepting what is a very popular explanation. I find it difficult for two reasons. It seems to me a thing unthinkable that the Spirit of God is going to devote 12 chapters of the Bible to the musings of a rationalist. If I want that, I can talk to the man sitting next to me in the airplane, or visit a college campus, or go to a used bookstore and get marked down books to tell me that kind of thinking. But I find it difficult for a more important reason, and that is that this preacher says that it's not true. In chapter 12, Verse 9, he says, not only was the teacher, the preacher, wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher searched to find out just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. Words of the wise are like goads. They're collected sayings, like firmly embedded nails, given by one shepherd. This preacher says that the words of his are like tent pegs that can hold fast in the midst of the turbulence of life. Says these words of his are like prods that will move us on to God. And he says that what he wrote came from the shepherd of heaven. So if we could take his words at their face value, what he's saying is that there is in this book that which can move us on to God. So the question is, what is the message of the book of Ecclesiastes? Well, one way we can approach the reading of this book is the way we might approach the reading of any other book. Because I teach at a seminary, I get paid to read. When I read a serious book, I have a kind of standard operational procedure. First thing I do is read the preface of a book. A good writer is more likely than a poor one to tell you in the preface what he's going to tell you. In fact, often after you read the preface, you don't have to bother reading the book. Second thing I do is to read the conclusion of the book. A serious writer is much more likely in the conclusion of the book to tell you what he's been telling you, and even more important, to sort of apply it to life. And then having read the preface, having read the conclusion, I go back and read the book. And what you're reading for are the main ideas, the major emphasis of the writer. And I think you can do that with this book of Ecclesiastes. As you might imagine, the preface of the book is found in chapter 1, verse 2. The preacher says, meaningless, meaningless, says the preacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Other translations say, vanity of vanity, says the preacher. All is vanity. When the preacher says the vanity of vanity, that's a way of emphasizing something, putting it into italics. Just as when a Jew talked about the Holy of Holies, he was talking about the holiest place he knew. Or when he talked about the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, he was talking about the sovereign majesty of the universe. So when his preacher says vanity of vanity, he means life is vain. Or the NIV says it's meaningless. Life is vain. Life is futile. Life is meaningless. A great many Christians have had difficulty with that preface. They insist this must be sub-Christian thought, and they argue that you don't hear this ever quoted in the New Testament. I'm not sure that's quite true. In Romans chapter 8, verse 20, the apostle says that the whole creation is subject to vanity. Not just talking about the rocks and the trees and the hills and the seas, talking about the whole creation of which we're a part. So there's one place in which the preacher and the Apostle Paul seem to have some agreement. That is that life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless. The conclusion of the book is as clear as the preface. Conclusion of the book, as you would expect, would be in the last chapter. Chapter 12, verse 13. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. But this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. Conclusion, he says that our responsibility is to fear God, keep His commandments. That conclusion is so utterly orthodox, it really doesn't need much other biblical support. You can think of a passage like 2 Corinthians 5:10, which says, we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. We shall all give an account for the things done in the body. So the conclusion of the book is to fear God, keep His commandments. This is the responsibility, because we shall give an account to Him. The preface of the book: life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless. And then as you read through the book, you find that there is a major emphasis that occurs again and again. It is probably this emphasis that has made most Christians a bit upset with this preacher. So you can get a feel for it. Let me read through the book and listen to what he says. For example, in chapter 2, verse 24. He says, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. Without Him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Or chapter 3, verse 12. I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live. That everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is a gift of God. Or chapter 3, verse 22. So I saw that there is nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that's his lot. Who will bring him to see what will happen after him? Or chapter 5, verse 18. Then I realized that it's good and proper for a man to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given him. For this is his lot. Or chapter 8, verse 15. So I commend the enjoyment of life, because nothing is better for a man under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad. Then joy will accompany him in his work all the days of the life God has given him under the sun. Or chapter 9, verse 17. Well, excuse me, 9, verse 7. Go, eat your food with gladness. Drink your wine with a joyful heart, for it's now that God favors what you do. Always be clothed in white. Always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun. All the meaningless days. For this is your lot in life, in your toilsome labor under the sun. If you have listened to those verses with just one ear open, recognize this preacher is telling you to eat, drink, and be merry. And that bothers us. Because the last time we heard somebody tell us to eat, drink, and be merry, he was quoting the Epicurean philosophers. You remember the Epicureans? They were on the stage about 400 years before Christ. And they decided that the next great act in life was to tumble into a grave. So their advice was, eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow we die. That is what this preacher is telling us. That is not just sub-Christian thought. That's anti-Christian thought. But before we dismiss them too easily, a couple of things you need to think of. One is, chances are, this preacher had never bumped into an Epicurean philosopher. I mean, they lived 400 years before Christ. He lived about 1,000 years before Christ. They lived in Greece. He lived in Israel. But more significantly, in chapter 2, he says he tried that philosophy. Women, wine, song, enjoyment of life. He discovered that that philosophy was as futile as trying to hold the wind in your hand. It's unthinkable, having tried that himself, discovered that it was lacking, he was going to make that a major emphasis of his book. But there you have it. The preface of the book is, life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless. Conclusion of the book is, fear God, keep his commandments. That's the responsibility of every person. And then in between, like the recurring notes of a symphony, it's to eat, drink, and be merry. The question is, how do you put all that together? What in the world is this preacher driving at? Well, the premise of the book, the foundation of the book, is found in its preface. He says that life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless. And the question is that a valid premise? This preacher goes out of his way again and again to say that it is indeed a valid premise. But this is what you've got to understand, and it's absolutely crucial. When this preacher says that life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless, he does not mean it is not worth living. When he says that life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless, he means that it's vain and futile in that you and I can never figure it out. This preacher is in search of the key that will unlock the mystery of life. And he discovers that God is the keeper of that key, and God does not give that key to men and women. But life is futile. Try as you will, never figure it out. He says that in a number of places. We're in chapter 3, verse 11. He says, God has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men. The whole lamp, eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. What he says is that God makes men and women as opposed to animals with something in their psyche, something in their hearts that wants to seek out the eternity, wants to know the end from the beginning. But he says they can't really figure out what God has done from the end to the beginning. We're like people incurably addicted to filling out crossword puzzles. And we have a limited vocabulary. So try as we will, we can't get all the squares filled in. We just can't see the end from the beginning, though we want to. Or chapter 7, verse 14. When times are good, be happy. Well, that's not a hard command, we think. But when times are bad, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. But a man cannot discover anything about his future. When times are good, you don't think great philosophical thoughts. That's the way life ought to be. When times are bad, you start thinking about it. The life crumbles in. The things don't go the way you want it. And then you begin to ask great thoughts. And that's perfectly natural. You've got eternity in your heart. But he says, ask as you will. You can't discover anything about the future. Life is vain. Life is futile. In the try as you will, you can never figure it out. And then throughout the book, he illustrates that. some of his illustrations are humorous. Some are deadly serious. For example, in chapter 6, verse 1, he says, I have seen another evil under the sun. It weighs heavily on men. God gives a person wealth and possessions and honor so that he lacks nothing his heart desires. But God does not enable him to enjoy them. The stranger enjoys them instead. I saw one reflection of this several years ago. I had been invited to attend a $150 plate dinner. You got to know, when I go to a $150 a plate dinner, I very seldom pay for my own plate. Well, there were times when my son was growing up that it seemed to be it cost me about that much to feed him. But I was in the office of the man in the community who was putting on the dinner, and he got a phone call from a woman in the community that was paying for her plate and several others beside. But she called in and asked for a special menu. I couldn't handle the prime rib, the rich dessert. Interesting, isn't it? I mean, when you're young and lean and hungry, all you can afford is a hamburger helper. And when you get along in years and you can order anything on the menu, your teeth won't chew it. Your digestion won't handle it. Something futile about that in life. Or in chapter 9, verse 11, he talks about the sort of the success formulas. In 9:11, he says, I've seen something else under the sun. Races not to the swift, or the battle to the strong, nor does food come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the learned. Time, chance, happen to them all. A while ago, I was in the city of Cincinnati in the state of Ohio in the United States. One evening, I had dinner with an investment counselor. He'd been helping people with investments for over 20 years and had clients, some of the wealthiest people in the city. So we got down towards dessert. I thought I'd get a little free advice. I said, look, you've had this thing, 20 years or more. What have you learned about investing? And he said to me, well, one of the things I've learned is some of the stupidest people I've ever met are among the wealthiest. And some of the shrewdest have gone broke. Not the way it's supposed to be. The way it is. I mean, there are times in life when the turtle comes in first. The rabbit comes in second. If you've got a bet on the rabbit. But don't put the grocery money on it. Sometimes it doesn't make it. The race is not to the swift. There are times when the Boston Red Sox baseball team loses. New York Yankees win. Shouldn't be that in the moral universe. That's what happens. Race isn't always to the swift. Battle isn't always to the strong. The success formulas don't always work. But the thing that makes life most futile is the reality of death. This preacher talks about this in chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 14, he says, the wise man has eyes in his head, while a fool walks in darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being extremely wise? I remember when the truth of that sentence hit me. I was in college. I didn't even know the book of Ecclesiastes was in the Bible. But the smartest man I had ever met for that time died. He was a man who could read 34 different languages. He could speak in over half of them. And he died. And we went out to the graveside there in the state of South Carolina. And they were putting him into the red mud grave. I remember thinking, someplace else in this state, another man has died. Maybe at this very moment, he's being put into a grave. A man who can't even speak English correctly. And here, 34 languages going into the grave. Not to be read again. Not to be spoken again. Something about that seems so futile. He says in verse 18, I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or be a fool. Yet he'll have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This, too, is meaningless. Here's a man who gives his life to business. He's up early, he goes to bed late, he invests, he gets the business going. And if you're going to live forever, the whole thing would make sense. But he doesn't live forever. Someplace along the line, he dies and leaves the business to someone else. And for all he knows, those who take the business over could be wastrels or scoundrels or fools. Sort of a futility to that. We're like children building sandcastles on the seashore. We get them built, and then, you know, we sit back to look at them, and suddenly a wave comes in and knocks the castle down, and all that's left is a ring of water on the sand. I don't care what you give your life to. I don't care how devout, how devoted you are. In a generation or two, your great-grandchildren will not even remember your name. Something about that. Something about death that makes life seem so futile. A lot of young people who commit suicide, not because they want to die, but because death makes life so futile for living. I mean, death keeps such sloppy appointment books. Here's a young man who graduates from medical school, second in his class. His family, his wife's family, comes to attend the graduation ceremonies. Because of his standing, he is granted a residency in a choice New England hospital. And the day after graduation, he has to leave his wife to go up there to get an apartment, to get ready to begin. As he's traveling up there, he comes over a hill, and as he does, there's a truck across the highway. He slams into that truck. And he's killed. All of his preparation, all of his hopes, all of his dreams, all of the hopes and dreams of his parents, gone in an instant. And over there in the nursing home, there's an old woman. She sits on a rocking chair, back and forth. Stares out at the world through eyes that don't really see. Her children come to visit her, she doesn't recognize them. People talk to her, she doesn't respond. She sits there. It seems like death has lost her name in the file. And when you look at death that way, the whole thing seems so futile. Life is vain, life is futile. Life is meaningless, so you try to figure it out. You can't. This preacher is looking for the key that would somehow unlock this mystery, make the whole thing make sense. And so he says in chapter 1, he looked in a number of different places to see if he could find the answer. He says, for example, in chapter 1, verse 5, that he studied nature. The sun rises, he says. The sun sets. Hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south, turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams came from, there they return again. It's fun to study nature. But nature really doesn't help you very much. I mean, the clouds give out their rain. The rain comes down, hits the earth. The water goes into rivulets. Rivulets go into streams. Streams flow back to the ocean. Water goes back into the clouds again, all over again. Nature may be an interesting study, but nature is not going to give you the clue to what unlocks the mystery of life. And so he said that he studied the science. Verse 10. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. Was here before our time. Scientists make new discoveries. Scientists don't discover anything new. Whatever they discovered was here since the creation of the world. He says he looked at history. In verse 11, there is no remembrance of men of old. Even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. History is sort of like a relay race. One generation runs, they hand the baton to the next generation, and they hand the baton to the next generation, and by the time you get around to this track over here, this generation doesn't even know who started the race. History can tell you, or the historian can tell you what happened. Scientists can tell you how it happened. But neither of them can tell you why it happened. So he decided, well, the historians, the scientists don't have it, but maybe the philosophers, maybe the theologians have an answer. These people who put out their shingles saying that they have all the answers to life. And he discusses those people in verses 12 through 18. What he discovers, he says, in verse 18, is with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. I mean, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. In fact, he says in verse 15, what is twisted cannot be straightened, what is lacking cannot be counted. The philosopher, the theologian, knows that the world is bankrupt, but doesn't have any coinage to get it out of debt. He can tell you that things are wrong, doesn't know how to tell you why they're wrong, how to make them right. When I was a young man, that was right after the crust of the earth had begun to cool. I used to think back then, someplace along the line, I would read the book or set of books that would give me the answer to the puzzle of life. I'm here to tell you that that book hasn't been written. That book will not be written. Karl Marx doesn't have the answer. Karl Barth doesn't have the answer. Carl McIntyre doesn't have the answer. That is, for all that they know, they really cannot solve this puzzle of life. So this preacher thought, well, there's some interesting adage that says it's better to be a troubled Socrates than a contented pig. And Socrates will always be discontented because he's got eternity in his heart. He always wants to know. But he thought, well, maybe the pig did have the answer. Maybe if you just lived like an animal, you'd enjoy the mud and things would be fine. And that's what he deals with in chapter 2. Says he tried all kinds of pleasures. Looked into it closely. And found that that too was futile. Life is vain. Life is futile. Life is meaningless. Try as you will, you can never figure it out. We've all sensed it, haven't we? We've all felt that. I mean, there are times in my life when I think I see it all together and then something happens. And what I thought I saw complete makes no sense at all. If you've never felt that futility of life, either you have not lived long enough or you have not lived perceptively enough. Life is vain. Life is futile. Life is meaningless. Try as you will, you can't figure it out. So what do you do? What do you do when you come to recognize that? Do you give up? Do you throw up? Well, this preacher says there is one alternative. And that is that you can look up. For the preacher of Ecclesiastes is not a cynic. He is not a skeptic. He is a realist. But he's also a person of faith. He believes in the God of the Scriptures. And there's three things he believes about him, at least. One is, he believes that God is sovereign. God is in control. He would have agreed with John Calvin that God's eye is not only over history, but that God's hand is on history. He says that in many places. Chapter 3, verse 11. God has made everything beautiful in its time. God has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Or chapter 7, verse 14. When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. But a man cannot discover anything about the future. This man believes that God is sovereign. That while he may not be able to figure it out, God can. That God, history is God's story. Remember over in Romans chapter 8, verse 10, where the apostle says, whole creation is subject to vanity. A few verses later, in verse 28, he says, but we know that God works all things together for good to them who love him, to them who are the called according to his purpose. He trusts God's sovereignty. And there are times, too many times, I stand and I look over the wall and it seems to me I see the whole thing full, complete. I see the pattern. Once I... God, something happens. And the whole thing gets smashed to pieces and I don't see anything. And at a time like that, often with tears in my eyes and questions in my heart, I have to trust God's sovereignty. That I can't figure it out. But he knows. You trust him. This preacher believed in God's sovereignty. Also believed in something else. He also believed that the sovereign God was good. He says that in chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy, to do good while they live. That everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in his toil. This is the gift of God. Or chapter 5, verse 19. Chapter 5, verse 19, he says, moreover, when God gives anyone wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot, be happy in his work, this is the gift of God. Believes that God is good. Does life ever seem futile to you? I assure it does. You get the sermon finished this Sunday and got to get another one for next Sunday. And the Sunday after it, and the Sunday after it, and the Sunday after it. It's like Sunday comes every 3 days. You get it preached and you get another one. If you're a physician, you would feel it. I mean, you work with a patient, you get the patient well. If you think about it, the patient's going to die. Maybe not tomorrow, but he's going to die. If you're a homemaker, you feel it. I mean, you get the house clean in the morning, the night's mess again. My wife Bonnie likes to say, you know, you do the dishes, you make the beds, and 3 weeks later, you got to do it all over again. There's a futility to that, you know? But this man says, when you feel life is futile, you ought to rejoice that you've got something to do to fill your days. You ought to get down on your knees and thank God that you've got work to do. In my lifetime, there have been times when I've been too busy. Other times, I've not been busy enough. I'm here to testify too busy is better. To have work to fill your days is something for which you ought to be grateful. It's a gift from God. Does life ever seem perplexing to you? Sometimes I can get overwhelmed by it.
And this man says, all right, you got these questions. They're clouds in your sky, but don't let those clouds so blot out God's sunshine in your life that you do not see His goodness at work. I mean, with all of your questions, enjoy the food that's on your table and take it with thanksgiving. Enjoy the drink that you have before you. Enjoy sex with the wife that God has given you. Enjoy life. Enjoy God's goodness. In Old Testament theology, it is not just a shame not to enjoy life, it's a sin not to enjoy it. I mean, it comes to you from the hand of a good God. So enter into it. Don't let the perplexities destroy God's goodness. There's another reason that you ought to enjoy God's goodness. It's found in chapter 9, verse 14. In chapter 9, verse 4, chapter 9, verse 4, he says, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. That's not an ultimate statement. Just a reality. That is, it's better to be a live cocker spaniel than a dead lion. A dog gets a chance to wag its tail and bark. The lion, it doesn't have anything to do. It's easy for those of us who are Christians to forget that. Because we think we're going to believe we're going to live someplace forever, we have the idea, I guess, that we're going to live here forever. But you only go this way but once. Any good you can do, do it now. Any good you can enjoy, enjoy it now. Because you're not going to come this way again. Well, you got a chance to wag your tail and bark, do it! Dead lions, as strong as they are, have nothing. To borrow a line from a beer commercial in the United States. Yeah, you only go around once in life. Therefore, enjoy life with gusto under God. Which is the third thing that this preacher believes about God. Not only believes that God is sovereign, that God is good, he also believes that God is just. And that's what he says in the conclusion of the book. And here's the conclusion of the matter. He says in chapter 12, verse 13, fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. You ought to live life to the hilt. You ought to live it with joy. You ought to live it with a kind of abandonment. But you need to live it responsibly. Because you and I are going to give an account to God for the living of our days. That's not a blanket thrown over us to make life grim and awful. It's just the reality. You give an account to God for every good deed you could have done and didn't do. Every good thing you could have enjoyed and didn't enjoy. Give an account to God for the way you have enjoyed things that were beyond the boundaries. We'll give an account to a just God. And that, I think, is the basic message of the preacher of Ecclesiastes. Life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless, and we never figure it out. But we put our trust in a sovereign, good, and holy God. You think about it, you get that echo all the way through the Scriptures. As far as I can tell, God never promises us answers. God always just promises us Himself. In spite of the folklore to the contrary that one day He'll make it plain to me, I wouldn't bet on that. as though somehow when you get to heaven, God's going to call you in the back room and say, look, I really need to explain myself to you. You know, I tell you why that happened. God is God. He owes us no explanations. Doesn't give you answers. Gives you himself. Mrs. Albert Einstein, second one, was asked if she understood Professor Einstein's theory of relativity. She said, well, no, I don't really understand his theory of relativity, but I understand Professor Einstein. That's all I need. I and you will never really understand all the ways of God. But we can know him. And he comes to us in our most confusing moments. And by the way, he's all we need. Life is vain, life is futile, life is meaningless. Try as you will, never figure it out. But in the midst of all of that, you can trust God's sovereignty. You can delight in God's goodness. You can bow before his justice. And when you do that, you can step where you cannot see. You can trust what you cannot trace. And you can undergo what you may never understand. And that's worth betting your life on.
Minutes to quantify.